Wilson and Dyson. We have a quorum. The first order of business today is House Bill 85, prescribed medication for students. I suspect we will move this one out, and then we will hear SB 10, parental liability, so-called vandalism bill. And I'm not at all sure that one will move today. We have the bill sponsor with us. Please, Representative Meyer.
Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and the HES committee members. It's a pleasure to be here today. My name is Kevin Meyer with the House of Representatives, and I'll be presenting House Bill 85. It's estimated that there's 6.3 million children who have asthma in the United States. Young people with asthma miss over 14 million days of school each year because of the disease. In fact, in a recent survey done by the school nurses, they indicated asthma is more disruptive to school routines than any other chronic condition. But being disruptive is the least of our concerns. Asthma and allergic reactions can be fatal. Several children have died in schools from asthma attacks or allergic reactions that could have been prevented with their with their medication.
Sorry.
No problem. Thank you. Asthma and allergic reactions can be fatal, and several children have died in our schools from asthma attacks that could have been prevented had they had their self-medication with them. And this is an example here of an inhaler that's very easy to use, and most kids any age can use them. And juries have held schools liable for millions of dollars surrounding some of these deaths that have occurred at schools that could have been prevented. So to address this problem, Congress passed the Asthmatic School Children's Treatment and Health Management Act of 2004. The federal law requires that the Secretary of HES give preference when awarding grants to various states, to those states who allow their students to have self-administered asthma medication. House Bill 85 brings Alaska into compliance with the provisions of the federal law and gives schools, parents, and most importantly, children, protection from potentially life-threatening conditions and consequences that can come from these. House Bill 85 protects schools, parents, children in two different ways. The first provision allows the children with the parent, guardian, health care provider's certification to self-administer and medication for asthma. And so in order for this to happen, a school must allow self-administration of the asthma treatment if they receive a written authorization from the parent and legal guardian, and if the written certification from the student health care provider shows that the student has the condition in question, has received proper instruction on how to use the medication, and is capable of using the medication. House Bill 85 puts the decision to allow self-administration of the medication squarely on the shoulders of the parents and the health care providers. The second part of this bill then is it just removes the school of any civil liability related to the medication. While House Bill 85 helps Alaska qualify for federal grants, the real purpose behind this bill is giving parents, doctors, and schools the ability to ensure that our children are safe and hopefully save some lives. So today, if it's gone like other committees, Mr. Chairman, you should hear from doctors, school nurses, parents, American Love, American Heart, various organizations in support of this bill. With that, I would ask for your support. And any questions?
Questions for Representative Byrne? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we look at schools, is there any distinction between public school versus private schools? Or is this something that encompasses both?
That's a good question. I think we've been so focused on the public schools that I think private schools would be. If I may, Mr. Chairman, let me ask
Mike, has that come up?
ask Mike Pulaski to join me, please.
For the record, this is Mike Pulaski, and I'm an aide for Representative Meyer. Senator Olson, through the chair, that question has not come up from another committee. When I asked the Legislative Legal Department that very same question, the answer was that the private school could not prohibit it, but that in some cases it would apply to private schools as well.
And have we heard from any private schools on this issue?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, no, we have not, no.
Mr. Chairman, one more question having to do with asthmatics. Are there any other medications that are going to be required to be on site should asthmatic students go into status asthmaticus, which is the most severe form of asthma, where they can't come out of it, and certainly inhalers are not going to break it, even though multiple attempts can do that?
I'll take a stab at this, and then Mike.
Essentially, it's epinephrine that you use to break it.
Right. Yes, and that is allowed also under this bill.
Okay. Okay.
As well as the inhalers. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're referring to the EpiPens.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Okay, but for the record, I want the record to clearly reflect that Senator Olson asked whether or not private schools were included under what this bill does, and the affirmative answer was private schools have the same right or provision here to apply this same, in essence, privilege for asthmatic children. And the sponsor says that's right.
That's correct. Yes. Yes.
Sponsor says that's correct. All right, Senator Olson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I don't know where else this bill is going, but the legal analysis that is attached to the bill from our Legal Services Division clearly says Section 1 requires public elementary and secondary schools to allow. And so, I mean, it seems to me that this may be something that needs to be followed up on, if not in this committee, at least in the next committee of referral.
Yep. Thank you. Good point. Now, where else does this bill go?
Judiciary.
All right. Will you commit to getting an opinion from legal on that very question before it gets to judiciary?
You have our commitment, Senator Dyson.
All right. Thank you, Senator Elton. That was a good catch. Other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on the history of the reason for the bill, what was the stance of the school district before? Were they not allowing inhalers to be used once you got inside the doors of the classroom? Well, under the doors of the school?
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Olson, a lot of this, from our research that we've done, a lot of the schools have asked that all medications be given to the school nurse.
Oh, I see.
So if you were on the playground and had asthma attack, then you'd have to try to get into the nurse to get your inhaler, and sometimes you just couldn't make it. So, but this bill now will allow the kids to carry their medications with them, and I think, you know, the reason why the schools, it's probably liability reasons that the schools ask that all the medications be kept with the school nurse, and so now that they can't be held liable, it shouldn't be a problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions?
I just want to ask one question. Senator Olson's comment that it referred to a public school, is that in the overriding statute? Not in this? Where is it in this?
It's in the sectional analysis.
Mr. Chair. I don't know that that's the case. What I was quoting from Senator Green is the January 24, 2005 sectional analysis from our legal services people. The one page sectional analysis that in my packet is attached as the next page after the bill.
Let me see. I wonder where they got that, because I don't see it in the statute unless there's some broad title way back at the beginning of chapter 14.
through the chair, Senator Green and Senator Elton, what I believe I intended to follow up with when I was speaking before is that while a private school would benefit from the law, they are not compulsorily required to follow it. That they could achieve the benefit of getting all of the liability exemptions and having their students self-administer, they are not required to follow this specifically. So while it's generic enough to benefit them, they are not required. It's up to them as a private institution to follow that.
What about the student?
By the chair, Senator Green, that would...
Okay, thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we look at this bill, I guess what other medical conditions that students have are also allowed, also allow the students to go ahead and keep the medication with them?
To the chair, Senator Olson, this particular bill only does deal with just the allergic type diseases, the bee stings, the asthma, and anything that can be controlled with an inhaler or EpiPen. We have looked at other issues in some of the other committees, like the diabetic and the insulin, but that was kind of a whole different area, and the physicians who testified on the bill had recommended that we not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I asked the sponsor before if there was anyone who had objected to the bill as it made its way through the House, and he said no. We have several people who would like to testify. My guess is that this bill will move out of this committee without any objections. So I guess I certainly want people to be able to testify if they want to. My guess is there's no need, but do you have any comment?
No, Mr. Chairman, appreciate you giving us the time. I also appreciate the Senate giving us a judiciary hearing. On the House side, it went to Hess and then Finance, because the state now is eligible for federal grants. I think it's good for it to also get a judiciary hearing, so look forward to that committee as well.
So for the folks that are here to testify or the ones online, there'll be another opportunity here in the Senate, at least one more to testify if you choose, and you can testify today, and we're glad to have it. The first one I have online is Marge Larson in Anchorage, the Alaska Asthma Coalition. Can you hear us, Marge?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, thank you. Please identify yourself and give us your testimony.
My name is Marge Larson. I'm Director of Programs for the American Lung Association of Alaska, and I sit on the steering committee for the Alaska Asthma Coalition. And we do support this bill. I'd like to note that it really is a bigger liability for schools not to have this bill, not to have this law in place, because a bad asthma attack is much more dangerous than any medication. Asthma cannot be cured, but it can be controlled, and there are safe medications available and simple steps people can take to reduce their exposure to environmental. However, rescue inhalers for immediate relief of asthma symptoms will continue to be a life-saving critical part of asthma management. Once an asthma attack has become an emergency, 911 protocol will still apply, but the reason that we want children to have access to their inhalers is so that they do not get to that point. House Bill 85 is supported by the Association of Alaska School Boards, the Alaska Nurses Association, the Allergy and Asthma Network on Asthmatics, the National Association of School Nurses, the Alaska Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America Alaska Chapter, and American Lung Association, in addition to the Asthma Coalition. And I invite you to support this as a friendly policy for Alaska students, taking the protection that some students have in this state, for instance, in the Anchorage School District, statewide to the students of Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Marge? Thank you for the work you do. Next I have Phil Caruso.
Yes.
Yeah, can you hear? You obviously can hear us. Please give us your testimony, sir.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Phil Caluza. Just very briefly, I live in Anchorage now, and
as an adult with asthma. I've had to learn how to live with it for a number of years, and probably one of my hardest lessons that I learned was the need to take my asthma medicine when the time was there. My recovery time was so much more improved when I learned to stop trying to tough it out and wait till I got home. Therefore, I really strongly support House Bill 85, and I hope it makes it to the rest of the committees. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Any questions for Phil? All right, is there anyone here in the room that wants to testify on this bill? All right, any discussion questions from the committee members? Senator Green.
I just want to know, your question about whether or not it applied to private schools, the discussion was that, is it something you want, or are we even allowed to do that? Can we tell a private school? Because the federal law, looking at it, clearly refers to public schools in order to get the benefit from the federal government.
Yeah. As I understood it, and for the record, Senator Wilkin and Senator Green arrived about 25 minutes to the hour. The answer to that question is this bill, if it passes, will give the private, all the schools, private and public, the option of doing this, and it does not, option of doing it and the protection that the legislation conveys, but it does not compel the private schools to do so.
My question is the legislation to benefit the school or to benefit the student? And
as I understand.
Yeah, so I'm curious, and the second question comes up, can we even tell a private school that it must adhere to this? And I don't know if we can or not, so I don't think we can either.
The answers were that this is for the benefit of the students, but it gives a benefit to the schools and indemnifies them against liability if they do so and follow the prescribed protocol. Any further questions? What's the wish of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move to report House Bill 85 from the committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there objection? Seeing none, the House Bill 85 goes out of committee with individual recommendations and zero fiscal. Thank you for your efforts, sir. Brief at ease. Senate Bill 10. Which version would you like us to be working on, Senator Guess?
For the record, Gretchen Guess, State Senator from District J. /C, the CS. /C.
All right. I will accept as our working document /C. Please.
Thank you, Chair Dyson. As you recall, when we heard this bill before, the bill focused on the civil liability and lifting the caps of the current civil liability for vandalism. The committee, I think, and many of the people who testified asked some good questions about why aren't we recouping the amount from vandalism that's going on. And that research has kind of led us in many different directions and to a fairly comprehensive, very different CS. Mainly, it seems the process for kind of getting the restitution after an act of vandalism, a suspect has to be identified. It needs to go through some type of channel, whether it's criminal or civil, and then we have to collect. There are issues at finding who did that, who did the vandalism. What we heard from mainly school districts on the smaller vandalism, it's been more difficult to find people. On the larger issues that have happened, the $100,000 they have. But that is definitely still an issue out there that this bill doesn't address. We then went and looked at kind of the different processes to recoup damages. And we found that they're all different, and they're all different for for different crimes. And so what we did, I gave you, provided you three slides. On the first slide, on the current liability framework, I thought I would just run through or lay out for you currently in statute what the liability framework is and what we found. Most juvenile crimes often go to an informal process in the juvenile justice system. This process balances a lot of things. It has mainly holding the offender accountable, protecting the public, and supporting the development of social and personal skills. And they kind of sit down and they get a victim's impact statement, and they kind of broker, in some ways, a probationary deal with the perpetrator. And you'll see that in the informal informal situation, restitution isn't required. They do look at accountability, but it's one of all of the goals. Parent liability can be required if it's part of the decision that's done, and juvenile liability is where the main focus is. You then can go to the civil or the criminal adjudication process. In that situation, in the statute, it says that they have to do suitable restitution. It doesn't give a definition of that. It says suitable restitution. And then on the parent and the juvenile liability, it holds actually both the parent and the juvenile both liable. And so it's up to the judge and the situation what happens in that case. And then on the civil side, of course, we've talked a lot in this committee in past and present about what happens with vandalism in our current law and those limits. For other crimes, it's limited by other tort reform and kind of the apportionment of fault, which happens in the civil situation. And so you have the situation where the parents are capped for vandalism, and then it's by fault for other crimes. It ends up, because we cap parent liability and how that statute is created, there is no juvenile liability for vandalism in a civil situation. And that kind of leads us to where we are and at least the decisions I made in the CS. And if I could go through those, which are on the next page, if there's no questions. So what I did with the CS was try to look at everything comprehensively, because what we learned from talking to folks in mainly school districts, but you have to remember this is any type of vandalism that goes on, whether it's a mom or pop or a school district or a municipality, is try to look at all the different situations, because full restitution isn't occurring at multiple levels. So it's not always, in the case with my school district in Anchorage, with talking to Superintendent Cuomo, it's not necessarily worth her putting her spending her dollars in legal force when the civil is capped and she's not getting restitution in the criminal or in the informal. So what I decided to do was look at all of them together versus just one piece of the pie. So what you'll see in the CS is first that we included all crimes. This came out of a couple different conversations. One is, if someone vandalizes a school, do we hold them accountable for that restitution? But if they steal someone's car and wreck it, we don't hold them accountable. So I was trying to be consistent. We also run into equal protection issues when you treat one crime specifically different than all crimes unless you pull that out. On that note, shoplifting has been pulled out, and I didn't include that in mainly because it was a well thought out statute that kind of goes into the unique crime of shoplifting. So all the other crimes right now are in this bill. I think there's a good policy discussion around, should it just be vandalism, should it just be property, should it be all crimes, and then of course we get into the judicial problems of equal protection. That was my thought on including all crimes in the CS. Second, it says that you have to have full restitution, and you have to pay full restitution to the victim to try to get away from the situation where we're not, and so which kind of led us to where we are. if you look in the bill on the sections regarding full restitution, it's not necessarily clear. What we did was we took the adult statute and applied it in this case. I had actually some stricter language in this bill, and then we're holding actually juveniles more accountable than we hold adults. So what I did was I just took the adult statute that on restitution and put that in this bill. Third, and is, well, how do we decide who's accountable for what and for how much? If you looked at the grid on the first slide, right now the statute's all over the board for not holding people accountable, to holding them jointly accountable, to capping. So this was my policy call, and I would love people's thoughts. I don't pretend to have it perfect, but I'll run through my thought process. Was holding minors accountable for the first $5,000 of damage. 99% of the crime, we did get very good stats from the Anchorage School District, and we could determine that 99% of the crimes are under $5,000. So you have students with the majority of the accountability resting on them. We also, I just kind of thought, well, that's 5 years of PFDs, and I was trying to strike some balance. Then holding the parents accountable for the next $15,000, which is the current cap. There are a lot of good policy arguments, and I've heard them from my constituents and people who may testify. Should we hold parents accountable? Should we not? Should we hold them fully accountable? Should we limit accountability? It's a great discussion for this body and the other body to have in my mind. I don't know if I have the exact right answer, but at least I'm putting something forward for discussion. And so I kept the $15,000 for two reasons. It's the current cap on the civil. And also, when we look at accountability, there's only a handful of cases from the little data we could have that go between $5,000 and $20,000. They tend to be under $5,000 or the $100,000 cases that we've heard. That the payment plans have to be developed, and we've talked about this. This was similar in the previous. So people can, you know, it may be that one family can afford $500 a month, it might be another one can afford $50, it might be one family can afford writing a check. But the purpose wasn't to bankrupt families or take all the resources away from families or kids, but over a reasonable amount of time ensure that restitution happens. Finally, there's a list of people who are exempted from the parent liability. Just so that you know where we got that, that is currently the criminal and the civil exemptions together.
What page is that, or what section?
It's going to be in every section of the bill, but it is, if you look on the second page, I listed it on your handout, legal guardians, parents of runaway or missing minors, adoptive parents of hard-to-place children. I think if you remember, Mr. Chair, you and I worked on some of that statute a few years ago. We actually missed currently in the civil, it doesn't exempt parents of runaway or missing minors. The criminal does. So what I did there was put all the current exemptions into one. And finally, we put in that if the victim agrees, you can broker agreement to have community service in lieu of restitution. We wanted to make that option open, but only if the victim of the crime agrees. Additionally, on your third page, you'll see a couple other issues that are in the CS. First is, if you're convicted of a crime, we did, with discussions with lots of different folks, decide to make some issues about driver's license and when you're eligible for driver's license and when you're not. Right now, in law, your driver's license can only be revoked for repeated alcohol, drug, and possession of weapons charges, but no other charges. From the judges that I've talked to, a lot of people that work with youth, they've all said the best deterrent is a driver's license. So we decided to put that in this bill for all crimes at misdemeanor and felony level of losing your privilege to drive for a certain amount of time. Also, the discussion in previous committees and with other members of the body, we made sure that all the PFDs can be garnished on the parent and the child if they don't pay the restitution, and that the court can order that someone apply for a PFD if they're in this situation. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would love to answer any questions that the committee has. I know it's a fairly comprehensive CS from where we were a few months ago.
A couple of questions, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Senator Gass. I have to admit, I thumbed through and couldn't find the answers, but I'm sure they probably are in the bill. But going back to the second page of your slides, mm-hmm. all processes must result in full restitution being paid to the victim. I mean, is the victim, for example, if vandalism occurred and an insurance company pays off on a claim, is the victim then the insurance company?
Oh, through the chair, Senator Elton, no. The way it's written in the bill is that the victim would be the owner of the property in the case of vandalism. How that restitution is paid is an issue for the person who did the crime to resolve. It's not dealt with in this issue. So does that answer your question?
It does, but it creates a follow-up question.
Okay.
And I'm not... There is somebody on this panel, I think, who is more knowledgeable in the affairs of veterans. But it would seem to me that in that case where, and I'm going to use an example, if there's $10,000 worth of vandalism that occurs
mm-hmm.
To an insured piece of property, that the victim will then collect minus whatever deductible there may be from their insurance claim, and then will collect, in addition to that, $10,000 from the child and or the child's parents.
Okay, I see your question. Through the chair, Senator Elton, I do not know enough about how insurance works. I can, if it's not an answer to this committee hearing today, I'll get the answer to you. My guess is that if restitution was given, that there you can't go to your insurance company, and in some ways you're double dipping. You're getting $10,000 from the person who did the vandalism and $10,000 from your insurance, but I'll check on that. It's not dealt with in the bill. What's dealt with in the bill is that the person that does the crime and his or her parents, you know, in some combination will ensure that full restitution occurs.
Will you go ahead?
I had a new question.
Just on that one then, and we have a gentleman here who works with the industry that might be able to help us. It certainly would be my intention that the victim not get paid twice. And it would be my intention that if indeed the victim had insurance mm-hmm. that got them covered and their property restored or whatever, that the insurer be able to recover those damages from the perpetrator on some time schedule. And many insurance companies refuse to cover their clients if they're involved in criminal activity. There's a disclaimer in the policy, and that certainly, you know, limits it. But we probably ought to get a decision about to make sure it doesn't include double collection, mm-hmm. and that if the insurer does pay, that the insurer has a right to go after the perpetrator.
As the restitution is paid to the perpetrator. Right. Mr. Chair, we'll work on that and get back
Thank
to you.
Thank you. Your second question, Senator Elton?
Two additional questions that I think are simpler. Again, on the second page of the slide presentation,
mm-hmm.
You have a schedule. The minor is accountable for the first $5,000 of damages, the parents for the next $15,000, and then the minor
for the rest.
After that. Would that preclude a parent I mean, let's assume maybe that the damages are $40,000. You've covered $20,000.
Mm-hmm.
Would that preclude a parent from saying, I don't want my minor child when they turn 18 to have a $20,000 burden? Could they then pay off the additional $20,000?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, yes. It could be a family decision of how that, but the minor is the responsible party.
And then the final question, Mr. Chair, which is on page 8 of the bill, of backslash C, and I think it may be elsewhere in the bill, but beginning on page 23, or line 23, page 8, it says, a parent is not responsible for restitution required as a result of the acts of a runaway or missing minor. I mean, is a parent liable if they report their kid? I guess what I'm asking is, I don't want suspects to skate because a parent might have to pay $15,000. So if the parent knows that a crime has been committed, and the parent reports to law enforcement officials that it was their son or daughter, a minor child, that committed the crime. It seems to me it would be a disincentive for parents to report if they knew that they could incur a large financial liability.
Mm-hmm. Disincentive for
that. Did I confuse everybody?
Yeah.
No, just me.
This is Chair Senator Elton. The deed will have had to be said to be missing at the time the crime occurred.
Previous to the crime.
Previous to the
crime. I guess I'm not interested in the parent of a runaway.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in the parent of an at-home minor child who may know of the crime, may know their child is responsible for the crime, but would not want to report to law enforcement that their child was responsible because they could see a $15,000 bill or a financial, mm-hmm. heavy financial hit accruing mm-hmm. to them for doing the right thing and reporting a crime.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, yes, that could happen. Right now, they may or may not know that they're already jointly responsible for the criminal side, but that could happen. I wouldn't put it past.
You could make it an aggravator.
Aggravators, yes. So yes, that could. I'm unsure now if people are really aware of where their liability stands with their children. This may or may not elevate that knowledge.
Mr. Chair, just on that point, I mean, this is something that kind of gives me pause. I don't want to do anything that would keep somebody from reporting, you know, especially a parent who probably may have knowledge of it. And it would seem to me that we would want to think about an amendment that protects parents who do the right thing with law enforcement so that we don't get into a situation where they have to make a decision on whether or not they can financially afford to report their kid. So that their liability would go away if, in fact, they were responsible for
part of the...
Do we have any mandatory report of crime laws in our state? I know we had something several years ago that tried to do something like that. I don't know if it passed.
Is Chair Senator Green, we're not sure either, but it's something we can look into and get back to the committee on.
The only thing I know, Senator Green, I authored and we passed a bill called Misprision of a Child, and it reestablishes the responsibility of adults to report a child that's being assaulted, kidnapped, or murdered. But it anticipates that's they see the crime in it being committed.
Right.
And you,
I knew there was something.
Yeah, but I think that's the only one, and that one caused me to do a lot of research. And if indeed you could be classified as an accessory, as in you gained a benefit from not reporting, you know, then you are can indeed become an accessory, and the case you mention might just very well be that you're an accessory. That'd be an interesting discussion at some point.
I have a couple of questions.
Senator Green.
Okay. Senator Guest, in the rewrite and the title, I want to confirm, is this title, because doesn't part of this refer to criminal action as well? Should there be any mention of a criminal versus just the civil liability?
Through the chair, Senator Green, honestly, in the last 2 months, I didn't look at the title.
I'm sure that it included the provisions you have in there, because it looked like you have some.
Yes. Through the chair, Senator Green, it is a good catch, and I would not say that the title right now reflects the bill.
Okay.
And it needs to. Thank you.
It is a very brilliant and effective committee.
I'll testify on that behalf anytime you'd like me to.
Senator Guest, in referring to those people who are waived from
liability,
from prosecution or parent of a such and such type child, and I can certainly understand if someone's adopted or supervising a hard-to-place child,
mm-hmm.
that they receive into their home at 14 or 15, and then the next month they do something. But we have hard-to-place children who are in homes that went into that home as a hard-to-place child at one.
What?
At 1 year old.
Oh, 1 year old.
And one would assume that 14 years later we've made some strides, because they would have been receiving
mm-hmm.
monthly stipends and financial assistance.
Mm-hmm.
And is there any ability to place a time frame mm-hmm. around the time in-house? Or, I mean, it may be very difficult to do, but I don't think that just because someone has a hard-to-place child in their home, that they should be absolved forever from being responsible for the child, from being responsible for the action.
Through the chair, Senator Green, yes, there is. If I think the first reference, page 4, line 5, is the section for the committee. Again, that was pulled from the current statute that was discussed in this committee. It does not, the juvenile never gets exempted. It's the exemptions, and my apologies for this slide, it should say, it should make it a little bit more clear that it's just, these are cases where the parent is exempted. So not the juvenile, but
I think the bill says that. But I do think that there's a point at which the fact that they're adopted or a foster child or whatever, I mean, after 10 or 12, 15 years, it shouldn't make any difference.
It shouldn't make any difference.
And it's one thing to have someone that's come in the last week and a horrible act occurs or something, you know, mm-hmm. something like that. We can figure out how to.
Okay.
Look at that to see if it's feasible. You know, okay. Law may say that won't work at all. It's never going to happen. Whatever.
Okay.
I'd be kind of interested in hearing.
Senator Jason, did you want to comment on that? Since
I just realized I was raising my hand to myself.
I'll recognize you.
Give yourself permission.
We've had children that were subsidized foster care because of high needs,
mm-hmm.
and that is a process that, at least in theory and generally in practice, is reevaluated. So if the child has been in a foster home for a long period of time and grows developmentally past the hard to place or needed the additional subsidy, then I think that the current process deals with that, so that the social workers and placement team would decide this kid is no longer, you know, one that requires it. That's worth asking them about, and to see if it does happen. The FAE kids that I've had, and by definition, those children have trouble reasoning between cause and effect, and have trouble with empathy, which makes them susceptible to both being victims and perpetrators. And quite a few of the kids that I've been around who have severe developmental disabilities act out very inappropriately sexually, and often on other children, you know. And so I'm very sympathetic to what the points you raise. We're not going to be a little bit careful that we don't raise a barrier for foster parents taking in those kids that are going to be really problematic when they get to be, some of them, teenagers.
Mr. Chairman, as a reminder, though, the process for reclassifying that hard-to-place child comes only at the request of the parent. The state can't originate that conversation.
Parent or foster or guardians?
Yeah. That has to be initiated by the parent. The state doesn't do that.
Excellent question. Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a number of questions, if I might. The first one, Senator Guest, if we would look on page 2, line 20, at the end of that line, it talks about harms the person. So is there a definition of harms, and specifically, obviously it would be physical. Could it be mental damage?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, from my understanding, it could be any. That is what we were told, to encompass any crime. If that makes sense. So that's the language the drafter gave us, to encompass any crime. So I guess I would answer that if it went to a criminal act, then yes, something that was defined in our criminal statute.
And I guess the thrust of my questions here is that I'm not sure, while I appreciate the intent of the bill, I'm not sure that we aren't using a sledgehammer to fix, whereas perhaps we just should be using a scalpel. The word that keeps coming back to me, I wonder if we got a dollar chasing a dime here. So let me move on. So it could be mental, and so we could get into that court fight. I don't understand the driver's license link. If I'm a 16-year-old and I've got if I'm dumb enough to break into a school or whatever it happens to be, I don't think I stop and say, you know, I could lose my driver's license because of this. And one of my friends says, you know, you could lose your driver's license. I don't think it makes a little difference. So the effect of this is that what we do is we have 16, 17-year-olds that have made a dumb decision, and one of the things society has said, you're going to lose your driver's license. And to me, the effect of that is that we put a 17-year-old on the street, one without a driver's license, and just as importantly, one without insurance. So I think we almost make the problem worse by dragging in the driver's license idea. I don't think it's a deterrent. Again, I think it's too big a hammer for what we're trying to do. And you talked about, well, the folks who deal with this say it's an important thing. I'm not convinced of that. Once more, why do we say everything else is bad, but shoplifting is just sort of bad? Unless you want to talk about the driver's license thing.
No, I'll take both of them. On the driver's license, again, if the committee wants to remove the driver's license language, this is a bill, almost every bill is like this, but this one has hit me. This is a series of policy calls, if nothing else. The driver's license, what we had found in that, and in discussion with folks, a lot of folks said that they thought that would be a good deterrent. I think we can agree and disagree with that. What we did was try to find some consistency, because right now only repeat alcohol use, repeat drug use, repeat possession of a weapon. So what we did was take that statute, kind of broaden it to say if it's a misdemeanor, right now you lose for 90 days and then 180, and if it's a felony in 1 year and 2 years. I'll leave that up to the committee to discuss whether or not that's a dollar for a dime or too big of a hammer. It was a reaction to talking to both judges and people that work with young folks that they thought that would be a positive step forward. Regarding the shoplifting, and I can show you the statute, it is a very unique statute. For example, there's a minimum $100 fine. And I mean, shoplifting, almost like any other crime, it's, you know, it can be a 50-cent candy bar. And so in trying to fold that in and not have so big of a hammer on shoplifting a candy bar, we just decided to put it to the side. It wasn't because it's any less, it's just because it's such a specific statute, and I can get you a copy that deals with it and in my mind, in a very thoughtful manner. So since it did, that was the reason.
Already been covered.
Yeah.
Okay. Another question.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
If you don't mind me responding, Senator Wilkin, I think that whenever, obviously, driver's license means different things to different people, but I would say that to the, what I remember when I was a young person, and certainly as I've gotten more and more licenses, they've become more and more important to me. So I think that the driver's license issue, although in the past you and I have disagreed on whether, you know, Alice really want to have a driver's license, which doesn't make a difference, those kind of things, I think this does put some added power to make sure we get a handle on vandalism, because it seems to be, at least what I'm seeing, is that vandalism is becoming more and more rampant. The other, so I'm not in favor of taking that part out. The other thing that I was going to point out about the shoplifting is that, as far as shoplifting goes, you know, I wouldn't say I've been accused of shoplifting, but finish the story. You know, I'm in a small town, obviously. I'm the doctor on call. I'm down there shopping, and I'm there getting stuff, and, you know, it wasn't just in there to get something fairly simple. I grabbed it. About that time, I got a call on the radio saying, hey, you got to get up here right away. They're pumping on somebody's chest. I head for the door. The thing's in my... I feel something in my hand, and I'm thinking, oh, man, what I got to do? Start giving these guys... I stick it in my pocket as I run out the door. Well, you know, with all due respect to the guy that was there, he knew who I was, and he kind of knew kind of the circumstances, so I can see that, you know, maybe under a situation that there is I could see the exemption for it. So...
That's the thing I'll bring up. Next thing, on page 2, you talk about the minor for the first 5,000 and parent for the next 15. So the minor doesn't have $5,000, so the parents pay. Does the, in Senator Elton's example, it was a $40,000 event. If the parents do step up and pay the $40,000, does the event stay on the minor now becoming an adult's criminal record?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, I think it would be dealt with as it is dealt with today. I mean, I'm guessing those records are sealed. Most records of juveniles are sealed. But it would say on the record, even if the parent or, you know, let's say a grandparent or a friend of family or someone decides to pay off what the minor owes, the minor is still accountable, was still accountable for those funds. And again, I mean, it is the case where we don't think of minors, you know, having that much money. These payments can go on after 18. So if the family decides, look, we're only paying the 15 out of the 40, that young person will be paying that off until it is paid off. So that is the choice.
So maybe judiciary can work on that. Second to the last, you know, when we heard this a couple months ago, I remember the school district of Anchorage telling us that they had like $70,000 in. Do you remember?
$1,700 in collections.
$70,000 in damage.
Well, $500,000 or $600,000. It was a huge number, but I'm sorry.
And I
I didn't bring my file, but it seemed, when I did the math, it was like, out of a $256 million budget, it was a de minimis amount. And out of that, and to take that a step further, out of that, they had collected an extremely small amount. So now we're going to put in place a system that encourages, almost forces the school district to incur more legal fees to chase these little things that they don't really have any success in getting anyhow. And I just wonder, again, if we got a dollar chasing a dime, if we really even have a problem, it isn't taken care of. If we put this in place, would the insurance go down enough to pay for the increased legal fees? I don't have an answer, but it just seems like we're doing something here that is, the thought is good, but it just seems like the practical parts of it is that we're doing too much to fix something that really isn't a problem.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, I think in I mean, the school districts can talk from themselves, so I'll just kind of tell you my perception from our conversations, is both the criminal and the informal process now don't lead to restitution. They're not necessarily geared. They lead to some, but not to full restitution. And the civil is capped. So there has been a problem with school districts or any victim kind of ever getting their money back, nor are there anything in statute that says you're going to pay it back, and we'll set up a payment plan so you're sure to pay it back. I think the other issue, at least for me it is where both, it's balancing accountability and recovery. And it's a difficult thing by actually capping the parents, which the first bill didn't do, is that we're limiting how much a school district will recover. And I'm sitting here looking at four cases in Anchorage kind of all over, you know, close to $100,000 worth of damage that we had in 2004. We don't know the outcomes of those yet. And it would be a lot easier to go after the parents. And again, that's a balance in who's accountable and how much do you want to recover. I do think if I step back and say, you know, are we really solving a problem or not, or is there one? I think there is a problem in my mind when we as a community are saying that people aren't going to be accountable for their actions. Well, we'll just let the insurance of whoever pay for it. So for me, on a greater philosophical level, I do think there is a problem on having inconsistent statute and having statute that doesn't hold parties accountable because there's always their insurance at the end of the day. So I guess that's how I'd respond to your question.
What if we had the legislation contemplate that you didn't have a avenue recourse for events that cost less than $50,000 or $100,000?
You didn't have what recourse? I'm sorry, Senator.
The event, the mm-hmm. criminal act, the act caused by the minor. If the damage caused was more than $50,000 or $100,000, then this legislation would kick in. If it was $5,000, you just ignore it.
Through this chair, Senator Wilkin, I guess I would ask you, when we say we're going to ignore it, that means that if someone throws a rock through my window, then if a kid throws a rock through my window versus an adult, then I pay for it even if I know that who the kid is and that they shouldn't pay for it because it's under $5,000?
You being Senator Guest can do, you know, what you want to do. I'm saying a school district would ignore it, get it out of the insurance company, and not have the recourse to spend a bunch of legal fees to go chase a $5,000 crime. That's it just seems like we're pragmatically, we're going to spend a lot of money to try to right it wrong. And while I don't condone for the moment that the kid that goes in and throws the rock, but from a public policy standpoint, how much money do we spend to go after that kid?
And may I know there's other questions through the chair, Senator Wilkin. It's a good question. I guess what I tried to do in this bill is make it so we would actually get more restitution out of the informal and the criminal, where school districts don't have to spend any legal fees versus everything's going to the civil now where they do, and they many districts determine, you know, it's just not worth it for me to go after the civil. So in kind of streamlining this bill, what I tried to do is on the informal, on the criminal, actually increase the amount that the school district would get without using school district resources to try to address that issue of, you know, it's $500. I'm not, you know, if I'm a superintendent, but that the criminal system and then the informal system does ensure that that $500 is paid, that we don't just ignore it.
So this is an item that certainly I've thought about a lot, Senator Wilkin, and after our last hearing on this, spent quite a bit of time both with the bill's sponsor, and then we had breakfast with the Supreme Court in our own town, remember? Mm-hmm. And that's a question I raised with a couple of the Supreme Court justices. So Senator Guest is exactly right. She and I asked the district, how come, and Senator Green just gave me the figures, $800,000 worth of damage, $1,700 worth of recovery in Anchorage. And I asked the same question, why are we doing this legislation when the $25,000 limit sure doesn't come into effect with us when they've only had $1,700 worth of recovery? So the answer we got back is that the attorneys under contract to the school district often felt that the cost-benefit ratio of pursuing it wasn't there. That's when Senator Guest and I sat down with the law department and said, why aren't we getting restitution orders as a part of the criminal proceedings? So the district or the private business or homeowner, you know, if there's a criminal proceeding, why do we have to have two trials, you know, to deal with it? And so Senator Guest is making a pretty good effort here to get the restitution to happen in the criminal proceeding. So then the school district or the private property or the business owner doesn't have to do anything except make a clear presentation of what the damages are. So that's step one. Every effort, no, I can't say that, it's too strong. Most efforts to cut down on crime, and maybe New York and Giuliani is a good example, has police departments by and large come to the conclusion that the best thing you can do is to stop criminal careers early. So the earlier you can catch the kid for spray painting or vandalism or slashing tires and so on and arrest that career, the better. And that there's several papers been written to say, you know, that those kind of efforts seem to have a real advantageous long-term cost-benefit ratio. So, and there's nothing in this legislation that Senator Guest has put before us that requires the school district, private property owner, to do anything. If they still don't think it's worth their while, they don't have to do anything. So they de facto have what you want. But in fact, if Senator Guest is successful in getting the criminal process to take care of the restitution orders, we've gained a whole lot. The other thing that was instructive at our breakfast that morning, the judge says to me, we got our own problem. We will order in the court a restitution order. It's up to the civil department to collect it. The civil department, if they're not collecting it, they often aren't telling the judge who issued the order that there's an arrearage on the payment schedule. So he said both the prosecutor and the judge who was presiding don't know it, and we don't have the information to institute the penalties that the judge said would happen if the payment schedule is not being made. Now Chris and Doug tell me that they're working on getting it, but their system is so antiquated that the civil department's records on who is making the restitution paper, they can't input the data into the criminal ones. So somebody has to print that out and then go over and sit down to a separate terminal and put it into there. I think that some of those funds are probably more of the budgets you and I have looked at in the last 2.5 months. But there's a huge breakdown in it. And what Senator Guest has done here is kind of shined a spotlight on an administrative thinking problem that's kept even what we have, which is inadequate, from working.
One last question.
And your question about the word harm, I think really requires some more look at.
One last question. I'm surprised we don't have a fiscal note from the public defender's office, because I would suspect that there'll be some folks from that will immediately require representation from the state. And so, having said that, thank you for your indulgence.
Senator Elton?
I was going to make a comment that I think Senator Guess, in response to a question, made far better than I could have.
All right. Senator Guess?
Yes, sir.
We talked with a representative from the insurance industry this morning, and I think there's some legitimate questions that come up around what does the word harm mean? In your discussions and research, is that a term of art? Does it imply some sideboards on it? I mean, you know, me and your hired man were asked the question this morning, what if somebody says, your kid hurt my kid's feelings? You know, and he's going around stepping on his lower lip and has been for a week, and you owe me.
Mr. Chair, I don't think we didn't get an answer to that. I will have to get back to you and the committee on that. I mean, again, it was the language that the drafter, Tim Cook, suggested us that went to all crimes. But let me, especially in the civil situation, let me make sure that I understand that well enough. I do know it is the case, and I know that some would like to say we should kind of limit this to property harm versus harm to a person. I'm more than willing to consider that if that's where this committee wants to go. We do need to have more discussions with the drafter on constitutional problems. With that, we had preliminary discussions today on whether or not we can do anything we want, whether something's constitutional or unconstitutional gets determined elsewhere. But there may be, and I'm more than willing to kind of look into those situations and get back to the committee.
But I would encourage you to look at, and I would like to get this bill out of this committee relatively soon. So,
But
my guess is there's already some stuff in the statutes about assault, including assaults from one juvenile to another, and so the harm to a person that you're talking about may already be covered, and therefore you may not be losing anything if you restrict this one in this to crimes against property. But in just because of you and I's interests, I'd be very interested in your research whether or not the juvenile assault crimes also anticipate that there will be some restitution. You know, and if there isn't, we may indeed want to fix that either in this bill or a subsequent one. What are the other questions we'd like Senator Guess and our hired man to answer for us before we get this back? Senator Elton?
To reiterate, I think that the two concerns that I have are, and maybe we can talk to public safety or somebody in law enforcement on whether or not. And then the second, I guess maybe more simply put, is can we define an insurance company as a victim so that if they pay off a claim to a school district, for example, can the insurance company then become the victim and attempt to get restitution from the child and the parents for what they've paid off?
Any of those?
Great. Do you have anything else you want to say at this point, Senator Guess?
No.
All right. Yes, I'd like to hear from Sheldon Winters. Sheldon. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Sheldon Winters. I'm a lobbyist for State Farm.
I should also say I'm an attorney that primarily works in defense of tort litigation, so I have a little bit of experience in the concerns I wanted to express today. Let me start by trying to answer the question about the that Senator Elton posed about the property insurer recovering. Of course, the intent of the legislation is your folks', but the case law that interprets similar statutes from other states basically says the property insurer steps into the shoes of their insured. Subrogation, I'm sure you've heard of that term. So if State Farm was insuring a school building and there was vandalism, they would pay out that amount, and then they would have the choice of pursuing an action against the victim. And generally, under the case law, they're also obligated, State Farm would be, to try to collect for the deductible.
Senator Green.
So what if State Farm is the insurer of the household? I think that's what you raised.
Actually, no.
Okay, very good.
But I think that's an interesting question also.
Through the chair, typically you see that sometimes in automobile accident cases. One policy will reimburse the other policy, and it's basically a wash. So, Mr. Chairman, the concerns I wanted to express today have been discussed, and I guess I will be real brief in light of that. We do have the same concerns. One is about the language harms to the person and the lack of definition. And the way it is worded right now, without any further limitation, it's basically creating a new cause of action. And the best example I have is the emotional distress. Right now, the courts have limited what type of emotional distress claims can be brought. Intentional infliction of emotional distress, there's certain requirements to get in the courtroom door. This statute is phrased would allow someone to get in there if they were just harmed. We also have the concern with the concept of attaching liability to a parent strictly for not only vandalism, which is already in the statute, but if this goes beyond it to personal injury type claims, then attaching responsibility to the parent. And we'd like to work with Senator Guess on that. I think if I heard her correctly, that she'd be willing to consider that. In sum, those three words, harms the person, is really the large concern we have with this bill, and we certainly like to work on that and to try to eliminate that. We do not think putting that in there is going to solve the vandalism problem, obviously.
Senator L.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the testimony. I'm here, and you can tell me whether this is an artificial distinction or not, but when you talk about harms the person and the potential expansion, I mean, I can see, and I'm going to use a semi-example from our community. A couple of weeks ago, an assistant AG was beaten severely. In this case, it was not by a minor, but it was somebody that had recently been a minor. And it's going to take a lot of reconstructive surgery. Now, your harm the person concern isn't on that component of harm the person. You're more concerned about emotional damages rather than physical damages that require significant medical help.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, no, our concern is physical damage as well. And the history is simply this. And it all goes back to holding a parent vicariously liable for the conduct of their child, even when the parent did nothing wrong. And I keep using the term super dad or super mom. And the history is this. Public policy through the court system, through a couple hundred years of case law, has consistently held that parents are not liable for the torts of their children simply because they're parent. Now, they may be liable if they negligently supervised their children. They did something wrong. They knew that this child had the propensity to go out and commit whatever act of vandalism or assault people. Then certainly there's a cause of action or a duty on behalf of the parent and a cause of action for violating that duty. But the concern is about, again, the super dad or the super mom, that the kid has done nothing wrong in the past. There's no history there. There's no reason to believe that the parent should be doing
anything other than what they're doing, and then goes out and commits the one act, and the parent is on the hook for that. And that's the policy level concern question that we have, is why we need to be doing that. Now, Alaska, through AS 34.50 years ago, decided to address that issue in the context of vandalism. And they said a parent is basically vicariously, strictly liable for a child's act of vandalism, but limited up to $10,000. A couple years ago, we, through some heated discussion, raised that to $25,000. It's something completely different now to morph that into a parent's strict liability for whether it be emotional distress or even a fight that my kid may get into. My kid has no propensity to get in a fight, but if he gets into a combative situation and injures somebody, am I supposed to be responsible for that? And that's that policy level call that we just have some real concerns about.
The first part you might want to respond to, but the way I understand the bill, the parental responsibility would be capped at $15,000. And then something that you might want to react to is just a statement that I'm going to make that may or may not reflect the legal differences, but certainly it seems to me that if the arguments that you made on the supermom, super dad are equally applicable, whether you're talking about property damage or harm to a person that may require reconstructive surgery, for example. Supermom, super dad, you're suggesting only be protected when it comes to harm to the person, but not harm to property?
The chair, I believe you're correct that there is no realistic reason to have a distinction between vandalism and personal injury. We do not like the vandalism bill, period. But it's there and it's on the books. The question now is, are we going to expand that to something way beyond vandalism and include all personal injury? And we have real concern about that. As a result of the last hearing and some questions that Senator Dyson asked, we looked at our claims history and tried to find out, had the cap ever precluded recovery? And we couldn't find any instance where it had. And we also found out that we only had four claims, at least presented to State Farm in the last couple of years. With this change and this morph, we're going to have certainly more than four claims. We're going to have a lot of lawsuits where not only the child is sued, and that's legitimate. If the child does something wrong, let the tort system or the criminal system deal with it. But we're going one step more now, and the parent will be sued in every instance that the child does anything wrong, and that's our concern.
Thanks, Sheldon. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I asked you, I think, earlier this morning if in your experience the word harms has defined legal meaning, and I think you said no. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes. As written here, I think harms is open to a wide variety of interpretation, and it should be limited and defined.
Other questions for Mr. Winters? You did, Mr. Winters, tell me that your client, insurance company, can, in the policy, and maybe regularly does, say that they will not be liable for criminal activity by the policyholder.
That is correct.
Has that ever been challenged and overturned?
Mr. Chairman, not that I'm aware of. And of course, that raises the distinction between the juvenile delinquency statutes, the criminal statutes, and this statute that I'm concerned about, which is a civil lawsuit. And that's the age-old problem about does the policy cover it or not. The policy does not cover a child's intentional conduct, but what this statute does is it also imposes liability on a parent regardless of their conduct, intentional or not. It's been one thing when we've been dealing with four or five vandalism claims that have been paid. If we now try to attach vicariously liability to a parent for everything else, one, as said before, it's going to be a lot bigger than the four or five claims, and I honestly can't tell you what the insurance industry will do at this point in time. We just got this a couple days ago, but it is a
real concern.
That is interesting. I believe someone from the Anchorage School District was where they had a rubber playground material caught fire and burned up, you know, several hundred, tens of thousands, if not $100,000 worth of it. And the kid never intended to burn up all the playground and all the equipment sitting on it. The kid just intended to have a little fire, and, you know, which was probably pretty limited, still illegal, you know, on somebody else's property, but had consequences far beyond what the kid intended. So you've just raised a question in my mind, and that is, what if there's damage that the kid does that's not a crime, but it is accidental damage and has huge consequences?
Well, Mr. Chairman, through this committee substitute, under the civil liability statute, of course, it doesn't need to be a crime. And the only limitation on the type of conduct is it has to be intentional or knowingly. And I'm not sure if I'm aware of this. The only definition of knowingly does come from the criminal statutes, which is less than intentional.
Yeah, so, Senator Guess, I would sure encourage you to think about whether you want your bill to deal with criminal activity, or do you want it to include also accidental activity. And where there could be damages that would only proceed in civil court, could not proceed in criminal because there's no criminal activity. And that might be an interesting watershed, Senator Elton.
And for the witness, Mr. Winters, I hate to do this because this is almost like insurance 101, but I'm sitting here thinking about your testimony when you said that you talked about car crashes or auto claims. And you said it's kind of a wash because one insurance company may benefit while the other pays, mm-hmm. and that there's kind of this wash effect, and I may be misinterpreting what you said. But it seems to me that if, in fact, you cover physical harm to a person, you also have a little bit of a wash. You might have an insurance company that's picking up the medical costs, you know, for the victim. And they would be reimbursed by somebody that was covering the parents, for example, or partially reimbursed. So it would seem like there might be a wash there, too. And I realize that I'm struggling with, you know, just some of the basic precepts of the insurance industry, but you might want to think about that and respond to me later about whether or not I'm how misguided I might be.
To be sure, I'm not an insurance expert either, so I will certainly think about that and make some inquiry and get back to you. I appreciate the question.
All right, further questions for Mr. Winters? All right, thank you. Larry Wiggett in Anchorage, are you still online, Larry? Push the mute button, Larry. Larry Wiggett in Anchorage, can you hear us, sir? All right, Sharon Barton, are you here, Sharon? Yeah.
Yeah. I'd like to answer questions, Mr. Chairman, if they were in the PhD.
Yeah, come on up, please. Identify yourself for the record. Thanks for coming.
Sharon Barton, Director of the Provident Fund Dividend Division.
All right, thank you. You've read the bill?
I have.
Are there any problems that you know of a court action that attaches future permanent fund dividends from a juvenile in order to make restitution? Are there any problems with that concept?
From our point of view, Mr. Chairman, in the processing of these kinds of claims, no, sir. I don't see any problem for us.
Okay. All right. Any questions for Sharon? Thank you. I hope this wasn't the most valuable thing for you to do with your afternoon. Senator Elton.
Sorry, Sherman. I'm struggling with some new concepts here, but, I mean, juvenile records are sealed, I mean, what kind of security does the... I mean, it seems to me that if a garnishment action continues until, you know, somebody who committed a crime at the age of 16 continues until the age of 35, I mean, is that, does that constitute a breach of sealed juvenile records because you have information of a crime that was committed or an activity that was committed by a juvenile?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Elton, that question would probably be better addressed to Department of Law, but we see no detail behind these garnishments. We simply receive the list of garnishments with the certification from the court system that they're all legitimate garnishments and that the person being garnished has been duly informed, etc.
Okay. Thanks, Mr.
Yeah, and we in fact made the first breach in that wall of juvenile confidentiality last year when we said that juvenile sex offenders records could be available to a very narrow group, employers who were had children, like child care centers and all that kind of thing. I think that's the first one ever. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we look at garnishment of permanent fund dividends, I guess how many, where on the list of priorities would that come under? Because obviously there are other people that are in front of there. There's the child. What's the word I'm looking for?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, if on page, you can get a good idea about that on page 5 of the bill. You can see the claims that are ahead: child support, court-ordered restitution, education loans, court-ordered fines, and then these writs, which come before other state agencies and the domestic violence claims, etc.
My last question, Mr. Chairman. Is it possible to go ahead and force, or is there a legal precedent to go ahead and make sure that these perpetrators have to file an application for a PFD?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, we do, I don't know how effective it is. We don't track that, but I know that some judges do require it in their actions already on other kinds of crimes, and but we don't track.
So it's not cruel and unusual.
But I can tell you on child support enforcement orders, you betcha.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
They get them right out and sign them right up for those dividends, and then send it off to the custodial parent.
Prisoners.
Yep. Yep. Thank you. All right, Senator Guest, we were scheduled for a meeting on Wednesday and not on Friday. Do you think you could be ready to answer these questions on Wednesday?
Mr. Chair, I'm told by my staff that I will be. I would like to respond quickly to, just so the committee can think about it, to Mr. Winter's comments. He had mentioned that the CAP hasn't concluded anything because they haven't seen the claims on his side. The anecdotal evidence, and it's only anecdotal, is what precludes it is actually suits being filed in the first place, just because $15,000 in damages doesn't normally cost the legal fees of taking it to civil court and then finding out the person's assets and going after them. If you look on, and going to the policy question of holding parents accountable and the opening up, as he said, of the other crimes, on the second little area, and if you look down that, currently our statute's just all over the place, to be honest with you. Either the parents can be part of, may be liable in the informal, they are liable. Fully, jointly, not by fault or any other situation, which means at least, you know, that the insurance industry may be fully on the hook for any criminal of the child, if you read that statute. And then we cap it for the vandalism, and then it's by fault for the other crimes. So it really is a policy call, and I think it's an appropriate one that Mr. Winters brought up. Are we going to hold parents liable, and how much, and are we going to be consistent through our statute, or are we going to continue the inconsistency that's currently in the statute? What I did is look at the fact that we have none to jointly, which is parents on the hook for almost everything in the criminal situation on suitable restitution, and decided that our current situation for the vandalism maybe was a good place to start on parent liability. But again, that's a question for this committee and for the body to wrestle with. But those were my thoughts, given where the current statute was in some of the issues.
Anything else?
That's it.
And you did say that you think you'd be ready with answers to our questions.
Yes, on Wednesday.
Right. If not, we'll see you on Monday week. Please let Jason know if you're not available. We have Larry Wiggins back online now. Larry, do you want to testify today or hold off for Wednesday?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. May I just give a brief statement today? My name is Larry Wiggins. I'm director of parent relations at the Anchor School District. I'd just like to say that on behalf of Carol Coleman, the school board, and myself, I'd like to offer a sincere appreciation to the sponsors and to the committee for the work you're doing in this proposed legislation, in particular, to the thoughtful discussion that you're having this afternoon on policy matters. We haven't had a chance either to completely analyze or read this bill. Our primary issue and concern has been to be able to hold minors more accountable for the damage that they do, the vandalism damage, and to get raise the cap on restitution that we can collect from them past their 18th birthday. Again, I just in conclusion, I'd like to thank you and members of the committee for the thoughtful discussion having this afternoon, and any further assistance in the future as you work through these policy issues. We'd be more than happy to work with you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Questions for Dr. Larry Wiggett? Thank you, Larry. All right. Your turn. See you Wednesday.